This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G with the Beat Your Genes podcast, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to be back.
Excellent. And so today we are talking about what will the future look like? And we are going to be talking about a couple of articles. We'll have some questions at the end if we need to, but I think we should cover the show with this topic fairly easily. So the big question, how this show came about, is you and I were talking on the phone after a podcast, and I had a question for you. And the question was, Dr. Lyle, what do you think the world will look like 1,000 years from now? Mm-hmm. So I'm asking you, I mean, what we're going to be talking about is what this world looks like 1,000 years from now. But to get this conversation started, we got a question from one of our listeners who, mm-hmm. by the way, drew us a beautiful picture of herself, a stick figure of herself, asking us to rate her from a scale of 0 to 10. And it was just fantastic. I was more than happy. You know, a little bit of the redhead, you know, the proportions were not right. So I did end up rating her a 4 out of 10. But she told me she's going to work really hard and try to get to a 6. So I really appreciate that, Dr. Lyle. And
there you go. Yeah, excellent.
Well, so she sent us a question with all of this, and here goes. Since the primary goal for each human is to maximize the highest gene quality survival, Dr. Lyle, do you think it's possible that our next evolution will be to maintain our own gene quality in both designer children and maybe even gene enhancement in ourselves? In other words, would it not naturally follow that we will at least attempt to make ourselves into our own super genes?
There's a good question. I mean, somebody's really putting their thinking cap on. They're not understanding something about motivation. So, and how genes work. So, there may be designer genes and things like that that take place in the future. However, it will not be essentially a natural product. It's not some kind of an inevitable process. There's a mistake in her thinking. The issue is that people do not. Let me see how I can say this in a way that's not confusing. You are designed to enjoy things that will result in more of your genes being on the planet. You are not designed to get more genes on the planet. In other words, you're not designed to be thinking about how to get genes on the planet. What you are designed with is blind, unconscious programs. And the programs simply work. They cause animals to do things. And the programs, you could have an animal do all kinds of different things. You could have a cat just chase its tail all day long. It would not be hard to design that, you know, for a series of mutations to come about where that's what the cat does, since it chases wiggly things that are rodents, so why not chase its tail? You'll actually occasionally see that, obviously, and we think it's funny. But what's important to understand is that you don't have a consciously directed motive to increase the quality of your genes or to reproduce your genes or anything else under the sun. What you have, you don't have any motives that are directly at genes. You have motives that result in increased statistical likelihood of gene survival. So when you are attracted to an attractive member of the opposite sex and you want to have sex with them, you are not thinking genes. Now, in these days we do, because in the last 100 years we found out that there are genes, and then we found out genes are highly related to gene variances, are related to physical attractiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So now we can talk that way. But the truth is, throughout the evolutionary history of all animals on Earth, what we have is a thing called lust. And lust is associated with a thing that we're going to call beauty or attractiveness. And so you're designed by nature to seek gratification of drives that take place as a result of having neural circuits that were built by genes to be sensitive to certain kinds of environmental inputs. So you are in no way are people designed to say, well, gee, how can I get more genes on the planet? No, they're just designed for lust. And they are not designed to figure out, okay, how can I make my genes better somehow? And maybe I can replace some of my genes with other genes from somebody else, and we can use a computer, and then I can have really attractive children. But, at that point, they're not your children, because we borrowed genes from other people and implanted them, and kicked your genes away. So that's what I'm – of course, it's hard without a group of people listening to me, and I could see their faces, whether or not people are understanding what I'm saying.
It makes sense to me what you're saying. What I was thinking was isn't there going to be some scientists out there who are like, well – I think that conscientiousness is really valuable, and so I'm going to try to tweak these genes to make everybody, more conscientious, or whatever the personality characteristic is.
Yeah, okay. Let's look at the idea of monkeying consciously top down with the genetic code. Undoubtedly, people will do this, and they're going to find that there will be some problems with it that are going to be unpredictable. That's because you don't have one gene for one characteristic. You have a gene that influences a whole slew of characteristics. So you can't say, well, gee, I want the genes that give us, George Clooney's eyes. You can't do that, because it's going to turn out that then you might wind up with George Clooney's cousin's cancer. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the genes are having – every gene is having multiple influences all over the body in unpredictable ways. And so that's why we can't – there will be the ability to come down here and do a little bit of top-down fiddling with the genetic code. Once in a blue moon, they will find a very few disease processes, not very many. They'll find a very few disease processes that are associated with a single gene. And the day may come when those genes are identified that we may be clever enough to actually deactivate or somehow, do genetic engineering so that that child does not die of that disease. That's a futuristic possibility, but that will not be the case with almost any disease process, because the disease processes will be interactions between many suites of genes with environmental inputs.
I see.
Yeah, it's not – so there is no, quote, natural process by which we're going to start nitpicking around and trying to make our genes fancier. We were never designed to make our genes fancier. We were designed to simply follow our lust, and in doing so, we enabled our genes to compete effectively in succeeding generations. So people actually can consciously do things like – lift weights in junior high school, try to get bigger and stronger so that they can get the football team, so that they can wear, big shoulder pads and have number 12 on their jersey, so that the attractive girls will see that they're competitive there, so that they can get laid. In other words, they are capable of chaining together a slew of sub actions that are all directed at getting laid. However, the truth of the matter is, the only reason that they're really doing this is that they also love the competitive process itself. In other words, they are designed by nature to not only want to have sex with the attractive young women, but they're also designed by nature to enjoy the rough and tumble competitive process with other males. Okay? And so, in other words, where these motivational systems are actually integrated with an endpoint that animals don't even have a conscious recognition that there is some endpoint out there. So when two mice meet each other, two male mice meet each other and start fighting, they aren't thinking, gee, the winner is going to get to get laid. That's not on their minds. They actually simply like to fight, okay? They like to fight because it turns out that fighting then is reliably correlated with whether or not they mate. So, but they're not, this is not a conscious issue. This is not a conscious target. Human beings love to do many things. And even though they may be aware that there is essentially a sexual payoff in the end of it, the drive to do the things is not consciously directly associated with the sexual payoff. The drive to do those things is because those things are inherently reinforcing processes, competitive processes, or otherwise interesting processes, the arts, singing, dancing, in other words, showing off is what it is that people love to do. And it isn't showing off necessarily consciously directed at sexual activity. It's showing off conscious, you know, essentially directed at status and also with a love of the competitive actions themselves. So anyway, I hope that helps.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
In other words, what I'm understanding is,
yeah.
Number one, because the genetic code is just so complex that it would
yeah.
be extremely rare to be able to affect one particular aspect that we can see with our eyes or hear
right.
with our ears, because
yes.
it would affect something else. You might get brilliantly attractive eyes, but you might grow three arms. Just kidding.
That's correct. Yes,
but,
that's exactly right.
But what you're also saying is that there really isn't a motivation to make our genes better through scientific experiments. It would actually,
no.
our motivation is actually to just mate with better genes than we currently have. Got it. Understood. Okay,
all
excellent.
Right.
Well, excellent. So tell me, Dr. Lyle, how do you see society in 1,000 years from now?
I'll
just get right to it.
Yeah, 1,000 is so far out, I can't even imagine I have no imagination for that. Because the technological advances are going to be so incredible that it's beyond imagining. What I can do is I can look out certainly 100 years and I can look out a couple of 100 years. And there will be some things happening in the next 100 years that are relevant to people that are living today. And the reason they're going to be relevant to people living today is because there's people living today that are 10, 15 years old, and there's people living today that are 50 years old that have a grandchild that's 5, okay? And so let me give you an example of how this information that I will give you today could be actually quite useful to a lot of people. So let's suppose we are a 50-year-old, and we've got a 5-year-old or 2-year-old grandchild. And we are, you know, we're doing okay financially, and we're looking at our retirement, but we're also concerned about our grandchild and whether or not our son or daughter is saving enough for their college education, you know, that's going to come along in another 15 years because, you know, we're trying to leverage, we're actually trying to use our time and energy in order to aid and abet our personal gene survival. So these grandchildren are little vehicles for our genes and we want to help them be more competitive. And so we're designed by nature to do that. So that's long before anybody knew about genes, grandmothers are gossiping with everybody in the village about how great their grandkid is as opposed to everybody else's grandkid. I can't tell you how many grandkids I have heard reported that they're prodigies, that they started speaking really early, that they walked earlier than other kids. In other words, there's just absolutely no end to the braggartry that goes on with people about their children.
Dr. Lyle, you're not going to believe this, but my little sister apparently was said to have cured polio when she was a little kid because of this.
Really? That's the third one I heard this week. So that, there you go. Okay. So this is so what's happening here though, is that there are people that are concerned and worried about the future and whether or not their offspring, grandchildren, great-grandchildren are going to have enough resources. I've heard people wringing their hands about the state of the world and that, you know, it's just things are getting more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing could be further from the truth, and this is a huge mistake. You're a grandchildren now at age 5. Here's another thing that you'll hear about. Social Security is going to grow over. joke. I've been
every
hearing
decade
that.
It's gonna go bankrupt.
I've been hearing this. I've been hearing this since I was like 16 years old. Okay, so this is obviously a never-ending joke of anybody that has ever taken out a calculator and can do mathematics. Now, let's look at the situation. Situation is that a 5-year-old now is going to be looking at, you know, theoretically retirement in about 60 years. So we might be interested in what's going to happen in 60 years. But what I'm going to give people is a thing I've talked about before, which is the law of 72, which is a nice little heuristic to help you figure out interest rates and rates of return on investments. So the law of 72 is you take a rate of return and you multiply it by a number of years, and that's, if it equals 72, that tells you how many years it takes to essentially double the capital. So at 3% rate of return, it takes 24 years in order to, which 3 times 24 is 72. That's how long it takes you to double your net worth. If you have a 3% rate of return. If you have a 6% rate of return, it's going to take you 12 years. If you have a 36% rate of return, it's going to take you 2 years. Now, these numbers aren't exact, but they are pretty good. So it's about right that if you have a 4% rate of return, it's going to take you about 18 years to double your money. Now, human nature under reasonable free enterprise, in other words, without horrendous government intervention and blood sucking out of the economy, human nature basically will have a rate of return of about 3% a year. This is a fairly steady, quite a steady number that goes back 200 years to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. So it's not going to stop. It is what it is. It's not going to be much better. It doesn't look like we can do 4%. We certainly don't have to suffer with 2%. 3% is about essentially what you're looking at is how intelligent humans are when it comes to absorbing the existing information, passing it on to the next generation, i.e. teaching young people, and then how they can now take the existing information and expand the known quantity of information with respect to anything. So in other words, surgery for, I don't know, oral surgery is going to get 3% better a year. There's going to be 3% less complications on similar things. You know, pancreas cancer treatment, you know, actually cancer treatment, you could be running up against walls in nature that stop that. But if you looked all over the human landscape at anything that people want to do, you will find on average 3% increases in capability. So you really could see this in something like the auto industry. The auto industry just keeps making innovation after innovation after innovation after innovation. And these cars have been about $20,000, you know, forever, for God's sakes. A mid-range car, I bought myself a Toyota Camry XLE in 2002. That was 15 years ago. It's about $25,000. That same car is $25,000 now. The government has debased the currency, you know, for about 3% so a year. So the point is that it's the same price, except it's way, way cheaper relative to dollars, the time that it takes to earn the money. So it's basically right on cue with, you know, something that looks like about a 4% rate of return on innovation in the auto industry, which would make sense. Now, so here's what we're looking at. We're looking at the total ability of human beings to transform nature and to turn nature into things that human beings want and need, doubling every 24 years. That means it's going to go 4-1 in 48 years. So that means that, let's say, the average person, the average person that's making a very low-level skilled wage in the United States, we'll call it $13 an hour, that person is going to make the equivalent of $26 an hour 24 years from now, and they're going to make the equivalent of $52 an hour 50 years from now. So 50 years from now, that grandchild, when they're entering their last years of looking at trying to save for their retirement or whatever, what you're going to find is that the average person that's working at Starbucks will be making the equivalent of $100,000 a year today. That means that they could, you know, in most places in the United States, they could just save for a couple, 3 years and pay cash for a pretty decent house. Okay. The that's what that is. Now you might say, oh no, well, because the price is going to be a lot more. No, it's not. You have to, what I'm describing here is the actual amount of hours that it takes to produce the wealth. And we couldn't care less about what the actual dollars are in terms of how much government has deflated the currency and what prices look like. For all we know, the price of a house is going to be, I don't know, $9 million in a nice area by that time. That's not what's important. What's important is that the actual innovation is going to change dramatically. Now, people are confused about this. They don't understand because the nominal prices rise as a result of government inflation. What we have to look at is the actual amount of time and energy that is required to, for example, produce a square foot of housing. It is vastly less expensive to do that than it was 50 years ago. If we were going to look at the amount of time and energy that it takes in order to have a decent watch, okay, it is vastly less money. I can remember when a transistor radio was a decent Christmas present. That was not a cheap item, okay, in 1965. That was actually a legitimate Christmas gift for a kid. A transistor radio now is a joke, okay? That's like a bubble gum. So if you look at people's houses now, they have three-car garages all over the place, not to park cars. They are parking 10,000 items per household in their three-car garages. They are absolutely overrun with phenomenal amounts of items. The amount of clothing that people have now and its expensiveness is a joke. It literally is costing less than 5% of what clothing cost 100 years ago. So what you're seeing is that the productivity will go 4-to-1 in 50 years and it'll go 8-to-1 in 75 years. So that person, as they live into their 70s, everything that you want and need will cost 1/8 of what it costs now. So it's insane. If you need $3,000 for a decent standard of living a month today, if you're a retirement person, you would need 1/8 of that 75 years from now. So it's very difficult for people to conceive two things. They don't have a feel for where things were like 100 years ago. 100 years ago, nobody had refrigerators. A few people had cars. The cars were incredibly dangerous and terrible and lousy. They had punctures in the tires every few miles. People had, you know, horses. They were still fighting on horseback in a lot of places during World War I in Europe. And people didn't live very long. They died of infectious processes. Et cetera, et cetera. In other words, people were what you would consider unbelievably poor 100 years ago. So what we see is this doubling every 24 years of the standard of living, and people are, because it happens slow enough to the human eye and their experience, they don't see it from year to year. And people that are even my age in their 50s are not actually keeping track of things well enough. They get fooled by nominal rises in prices and they feel like, oh, things are more expensive. TV used to only be $300. Well, the truth of the matter is it was a tiny little TV. It was terrible. And the TV you could buy for $300 now blows it away. Not only that, that thing only had a few channels. So the point here is that the world is hurtling towards unbelievable wealth. And it's going to be 8-to-1 in 75 years, and it's going to be 16-to-1 in 100 years. And it's going to be 32-to-1 in 125, and it's going to be, 64-to-1 in 150 years. And it's going to be over 100-to-1 in 175 years. Okay? And it's going to be 200-to-1 in 200 years. Now, 200-to-1 starts to look so strange you can't even believe it. So it is that a citizen in Mexico that right now earns $1 an hour is going to be earning $200 an hour equivalent. They're going to be earning the equivalent of a current neurosurgeon, that's going to be a day laborer with no skill. Okay? You might say, how is this possible? The answer is that robots will be building everything as they are continually building more and more and more and more of everything. Pretty soon you won't have, you know, people driving a steam roller to make a new road. There will be robots out there making new roads anywhere you want. That is, if we're not flying little Jetson cars around, which is very possible. I'm not sure if that's true, but I'm not sure how much transportation we're going to need.
What are the Jetsons again?
Very good. Okay. So the point is that the world is moving to a place that people can't imagine for two reasons they can't imagine it. Number one, they cannot look back 100 years, so they don't understand how dirt poor people were 100 years ago. And the other thing that they can't understand is they cannot possibly understand geometric progression. So of all the phenomenal innovation that took place over the last 200 years, as of today, that capability will quadruple in 50 years.
So with all this money and all this productivity, what are people going to do in their pastime? They're just going to have a bunch of sex all the time?
They're going to be singing and dancing and curling their hair and getting plastic surgery from basically computers that will be designing the surgical processes to make you, you know, what would be sexually ideal if you can. They're going to be basically lazy as hell is where this is headed. They're going to be goofing off. You have to think of pretty highly satiated rich people right now that basically feel like, well, gee, why the hell should I work? I've got $30 million in the bank. What's the point? And some people will still want to work. Some people will enjoy their work, and they'll continue to make more money just because it's inherently productive is exactly what I was talking about before. But they won't work that hard. You will find that as people get very well-to-do, they start backing off their hours and they start moving their interests into more and more leisure activities. And so you're going to find that the world's people will be moving further and further away from all what we're going to call, I would call them necessities in the sense that when you improve people's material existence from things that are actually uncomfortable to comfortable, it's well worth fighting and working for those things. It's well worth having a furnace that can give you give you heat, and well worth having air conditioning in your house. These things are worth fighting for. It's worth having homes that are large enough to give privacy so that people can have sex and the kids can't hear you. Okay, there's all kinds of reasons to increase, there will be a tremendous increase in human life satisfaction over the next couple hundred years as the burdens are lifted from human beings and the fear and insecurity about injuries in your old age, et cetera. Right now, somebody that's working for modest wages, at a clerk in some firm somewhere that's making $16 an hour and now has carpal tunnel syndrome that the surgeons can't figure out and it's painful and they really can't do their job anymore, that person's in trouble. A person that has a car accident that works as a house painter now, and now their back is so bad that they can't do their job, this is bad. Okay, and the fact that the firm may find a way to fire them or that the person that hit them in the car didn't have insurance and so there's a problem, et cetera, now, this is bad news. So people today do a considerable amount of physical and psychological suffering as a result of a lack of material success in the world. So anybody that says, oh, God, you know, we've got enough. You know, we need to stop growth and start taking care of the environment. Those people are crazy. They have no idea what they're talking about. Those are people that in $300 suede shoes that are trying to look cool, you know, and say nice things, and say nice things that girls that want to make sure that the little animals don't have any stress that think that the guy is cool for saying this. This is ridiculous. The truth is that material increases in material capability of human beings is the most important thing that human beings can do to reduce their burdens and increase their quality of life. Okay? People are stuck now dealing with very serious material deprivation issues that they have to be concerned about, and that's why they can't get a divorce. Okay? They don't want to be with the spouse. They don't like the spouse. But the spouse is a decent enough person and a decent enough provider. Even though those two people are unhappy, they need to stick together because the cost per square foot and the cost per unit of air conditioning and heating and the cost per calorie and the cost per 1,000 miles on a car are expensive enough that it's actually important for basic human comfort and luxury and dentistry to make sure that we keep a family together. That is a freaking tragedy when it comes to human life satisfaction, okay? And so all of these things will improve dramatically. Anybody that thinks that life's better in Peru, where people live in little villages and they smile when you pass, and they all seem to be friendly and getting together well, and they seem to be happier than Americans, is not true. Every single sophisticated survey shows that as countries and peoples get wealthier, they are happier, and it is substantial. And the reasons are obvious for anybody that has ever worked on a hot tar roof like I have. Okay, now, so the bottom line is this, that the next 100 to 200 years are going to be magnificent for human beings. The person that is today worried about their grandchildren is worried for nothing. Your grandchildren will be vastly wealthier than you will be. They may not be wealthier relative to their peers, but they will be vastly wealthier. If my grandfather had sweated and saved and tried to set aside money so that I could be better off, and he passed up his indulging himself, that would have been a tragedy. Because even if I did exactly the same work as my grandfather, I would be vastly wealthier than my grandfather. My income is between 4 and 8 to 1 more than my grandfather's income was. So the same thing is going to happen, except it's geometric. Okay, so the geometric nature of this is staggering, and the human imagination has an extremely difficult time. So right now, a decent pair of socks costs, a couple dollars. To realize that is headed, in 100 years, that is headed to 6 cents, okay, or 10 cents. It's like, oh, my God, it's basically free. To realize that the calories, rice, beans, potatoes, corn, et cetera, this is all going to go down by a massive factor. It's going to be – so people are not going to have to worry about food. They're not going to have to worry about square footage. They're not going to have to worry about injuries that keep them out of a workplace and now actually threaten reasonable material comforts. So life is going to get vastly better for people, and they're going to get far more independent of shitheaded bosses and uncomfortable relationships with their in-laws and uncomfortable relationships in their marriages, et cetera. What you will find is that people will live more and more like the well-to-do people of today. Well-to-do people today don't have to stick around in relationships that they don't like. They get a divorce, or they never bother getting married. Okay? Well-to-do people today, if they don't like employment, they just seek employment elsewhere. You can't tell me that some executive that's making $300,000 a year right now and has $4 million in his retirement, is 47 years old, is going to stick around and put up with a new executive vice president over him that's a super pain in the ass. He's not going to do it. He'll just turn in his resignation. Okay? No problem. No sweat. I've got three lifetimes of money in the bank. What the hell do I need any of this grief for? That is where human nature is headed, which is fantastic. Okay, So some things that will absolutely happen. Not only will burden after burden after burden be lifted. When people, what's upsetting to all of us that understand this is to look at the sheer quantity of human misery around the globe, including in the U.S., that is caused by material deprivation, which is substantial in the U.S. And I'm not talking about hungry people. I'm talking about people that are trapped in relationships and living in fear of their boss and the company might go under and et cetera. Okay, all of this fear of basic material comfort and security. those things are vastly greater around the world, and way worse. The sheer quantity of human suffering that has taken place, the single biggest destructive concept in human nature has been communism. Okay, more people have died as a result of communism, or fascism, if you want to call it that. People that don't know, don't understand that this is all the same thing. It's the notion of governmental control over economies and governmental control over distribution of wealth, et cetera, et cetera. And so whether it was Adolf Hitler or Mao or anybody else, these are all the same concept, and this is a destruction of the free trade and productivity and innovation that takes place under a free enterprise system. Now, that concept, Marxian concept, this is unbelievably brutal to human beings. And forget the warfare that's associated with it. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the extraordinary poverty and the tremendous amount of lives lost to that poverty. And it's happening all over the world. It's going to happen for another 100 years. And what's disturbing to me about this is that this is entirely self-inflicted. Human beings literally have the understanding now about how to master the material problems of human existence. This is an incredible thing. There is no way we could have known that we could have gotten here. Okay? This is like people not knowing that it was possible to fly, even though it was theoretically maybe an idea that people had, but people never really knew if it would ever be possible. Wright brothers come along and it's like, well, look at this. It's actually possible. Something that is fantastic about human nature is it just so happens that this species is not stuck at the level of a souped-up baboon. It actually has brilliance, okay? And it's going to turn out that behind that brilliance, if you set up the rules between human nature to be sufficiently well-organized, you can actually get cooperative efforts within a competitive process that will drive innovation and drive tremendous material benefit. We are the beneficiaries of that today. The fact that we're sitting here and I'm able to chit-chat, people can listen to me if they want to or hang up if they don't, nobody's making them do anything, and it costs everybody nothing, okay? That is unbelievable. That is inconceivable. It was inconceivable 50 years ago. And so that people can find their own brethren, people that think like them, and that they can seek out relationships within those things, that they can then move out of those relationships if they don't want to be there anymore and change to something new, that they can wear purple on Saturday and green on Wednesday and no shoes if they want and have sandals or any of the 28 pairs of shoes in their closet. This is incredible, okay? The notion...
And for all we know, you and I might be sitting in our living rooms in our pajamas doing this podcast.
Or maybe not even our pajamas if we want to have a really sorry spectacle.
I wasn't going to go there, but...
All right. So the point here is that where are we headed in the future? We are headed to a brightness and a fabulous future that is going to dazzle us with its brightness. I won't get to live to see very much more of it. Okay, so I'm going to, from today on, I will get to see one more doubling. And, you know, it doesn't happen all at once, so it's always happening gradually, but I'll get to see it. Okay, and that's cool. I will observe that everything that I care about is going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I had a friend of mine send me a thing last night showing that if two people wanted to go to Paris for 4 or 5 days, it was like $600 with the flight and I believe the hotel. Incredible.
That's pretty good.
You got to think about this. Flying out of San Francisco, a couple of people, $600 a piece, flying round trip to Paris and spending a few days in Paris for literally the wages for 6 days of working at Starbucks. That, if you had told anybody that, if you had told Thomas Jefferson that, he would have said, you're psychotic and you need to be locked up. If you had told Woodrow Wilson that 100 years later in 1918, he would have said, absolutely impossible. It's a nice dream. You're crazy. Okay? So remember where I'm going. Where I'm going is that this is going to go 16 to 1 in the next 100 years. That price of that ticket to Paris is going to go to $50. That's where it's going. Okay? 100 years from now, you will be able to fly round trip to Paris for $50. Imagine
that. That would be nice.
That'll be nice, but all they'll fly is our bones, okay? But the point is that this is where it's going. And where it's going to go is you're already seeing it because it's in motion. So you have now the middle class travels to Europe on vacation. That never happened when I was a kid, okay? The middle class traveled if they were actually above middle class and they were educated and they were scholarly and they had university degrees of the parents, then once in their life they would travel to Europe. It was a once-in-a-life thing. Now it's like, hey, shit, you want to go to Paris? No problem. Pick a country, any country. We could fly there because we can afford it. That's where the middle class is now, okay? Not the lower working class, not the people making $15 an hour, even though they could. They won't. The only reason they won't is because they've got other things that are more pressing for them. But it isn't that they couldn't do it, okay? Now, so, and certainly people that are in your upper 20-25% of income can absolutely go to Europe every year if they wanted to. That is insanity when it comes to what a change that is for humanity in over the last 100 years. That is going to go 16 to 1 from where it is now. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, you can't stop it. This is the innovation rate of humans. So this is going to cause the breakup of the long-term traditional family. The long-term traditional family has had very substantial economic forces that have kept it together. Okay, people just I will often, you know, quietly and behind closed doors with mature people that are, you know, that are reasonable, I will say, how many marriages do you think would break up if there was absolutely zero economic issues involved? And people will chuckle and roll their eyes. Okay, and lots of people know the truth on that score, and the answer is a huge margin. Now, so you're going to be able to see that people will be together because they want to be together, and if they don't want to be together, they won't have to be together, which will be a tremendous blessing for human beings to be able to live that way. So if you have a romance, a love affair the last 5-7 years, then it lasts 5 or 7 years. And people move on, but nobody is suffering anything materially. That's where the world is going. It's basically we will become so wealthy that we will circle back in romances, we will circle back to the original Stone Age design, which is that people were together for as long as they enjoyed each other's company, and then when they didn't, they moved on because there weren't any substantial financial consequences because there wasn't any wealth. Okay. Now
I remember reading an article.
Yeah.
I remember reading an article recently where they were saying the same thing, is that, you know, 60 years ago, people wanted to have golf communities built in their neighborhoods, but now we're reverting back to where instead of golf communities, people want orchards and farms and things that were resembling some of the Stone Age, well, maybe not the farms, but some of the Stone Age environment that we miss, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, people, I mean, so the world is going to continue to transform in ways that create human satisfaction, and people are also going to be spending more and more of their time essentially making sexual displays. They're going to be more artistic. They're going to dance more. I remember Steven Pinker wrote beautifully on this a few years ago when he talked about how the intelligentsia are rolling their eyes and saying the arts are dead. And he said, they're not even close to dead. They are vastly more vibrant than they've ever been. You have more people with a paintbrush in their hand now than you've had at any time in history. If you think anybody that was working at the Five and Dime 50 years ago had time to pick up a paintbrush, ever went to a paint night, anything like, forget it, never happened, okay? Now people think towards their retirement of time to do these kind of self-actualization activities, but people are going to be doing these from the jump in 100 years. Life is going to be artistic and athletic and romantic, and people are there's going to be problems. The biggest problem that I see coming of all is the pleasure trap that Alan Goldhammer and I wrote about 15 years ago. It's the fact that the modern environment is becomes so ingenious at producing chemical methods to tickle the dopamine pathway that people will become, you know, increasingly enticed into indulgence. And that will be a problem that humanity is going to face forever. And, you know,
yeah,
you're already seeing it. You're already seeing it in the U.S. So it isn't killing people. It's just leaving people overweight and not attractive and disgusted with themselves and embarrassed. And, you know, they're living plenty fine because they're living perfectly decent lifespans, but those lifespans are compromised by these by essentially an overly rich diet and overly sedentary lifestyle. And, you know, that's going to be a price that's going to be there, and that price is probably not going to go away. That's probably going to stay put. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to turn the ship a little bit to what you said about romance. And
okay.
This may actually have to do with the pleasure trap as well, but one of our listeners sent us a very interesting article called "The Rise of the Bromance Threatens Heterosexual Relationships," warn social scientists. So I sent it to you. I've looked at it, and it turns out that this is the primary author is Dr. Stefan Robinson, and he's in the University of Winchester in Hampshire in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And essentially what they're saying is that the bromance, which is when males have close male friendships, they could threaten heterosexual relationships. And just a couple of quotes from this article. One of the men who was surveyed says, "We hug when we meet and we sleep in the same bed and we have sleepovers." So they surveyed 30. Apparently this is what a romance is.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah. So the researchers were saying that bromances, along with the ease at which men can now engage in casual sex, are threatening long-term relationships with women. Dr. Mm-hmm. Stefan Robinson said the results were significant and worrying, and warned that there is an emerging culture of sexism and disdain in the way millennial men view the opposite sex. They cherish their close male friends so much so that they may even provide a challenge to the orthodoxy of traditional heterosexual relationships. So, and I read some of this, and here's a couple of other quotes from the other men.
Yeah.
Like having a girlfriend, but then not a girlfriend. Sex, really, that's all that I don't get.
Oh, yeah, you mean with a guy friend?
With a guy friend, right. Yeah, they sleep in the same bed. I mean, you know, I was talking to my sister, my older sister, about this, and I was explaining.
Yeah.
She was curious about this article. And the thing she said to me first, without anything else, she said, "That doesn't sound like a bromance. That sounds like a closeted gay relationship."
Of course. What's interesting about this, I don't know. This is supposedly out of the University of Winchester.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm I don't know hardly anything about the UK, because, you know, 100 years from now, if I had any offspring, which I don't, but if I did, those kids would be able to travel more, and so they'd know more about the UK than I do. But I don't know that I've been there a couple times, so I don't know that much about the UK. So I think there's a place called Winchester, but if the University of Winchester is a real university, this is an embarrassment. Like this guy ought to lose his tenure for writing this article. This has got to be surely this deserves an award for the stupidest article of the year. So anyway,
Golden Fleece Award, is that?
This is a Golden Fleece Award.
He didn't get any government funding though, so I don't think he quite qualified.
He probably did.
Probably did.
We'll have to check on that. So anyway, this guy's a complete baboon. Oh well.
So what you're saying is that men can get a lot of satisfaction from what he calls homosocial relationships, but they just can't get – that's what he named them, homosocial relationships.
Oh, that's very clever of him. Yeah. Well, you know, the
– he says men no longer fear showing affection towards each other, and intense male friendships have grown more acceptable in recent decades as attitudes towards homosexuality has changed.
I think we're finding that – I think we know that Dr. Robinson, whoever he is, mm-hmm. I would bet a lot of money that he's gay. and I use probably militant gay. And the truth is that he's doing what he thinks is in his the best interest of the world by trying to I don't know. I'm psychologizing on him, or maybe he's just trying to get a headline. But anyway, the guy's a fool, and that's that.
Interesting.
All right.
Okay.
We got anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah, we've got a caller on hold. So let's see what caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And welcome to the show.
Hello. Do you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Wow, it's amazing. I'm calling from European Union, Lithuania.
Yes. Where,
I'm 22 years old. Yes. My question is how to be an agreeable leader.
How to be an agreeable leader?
Yes. People often think that I am lying. I'm trying to get a best deal or something like that. And people don't see emotion inside me.
They don't see emotion. Okay. You may have a flat.
My calling time will end soon.
What's that?
This is my question. What is
he's on a calling card.
Okay. All right. Very good. We'll try to say something intelligent.
Thank you very much.
Very good.
All right,
so he's wanting to know how to be an agreeable leader because actually it looks like to other people like he's lying, okay? So or that he's being deceptive in some way. So he's trying to get tips on this, and he probably could. You could probably learn some things. You could probably with a coach. You could probably get some feedback about how it is that you actually manage your body language and your facial expressions. There would probably be certain little social skills that you could definitely improve on. So I could, I'm not going to outline those today for anybody here to talk about those, but you could essentially, this guy will never be good. If people are commenting about this and they're having problems, there are definitely some limitations genetically to how it is that this person communicates, and so you can only get so good at this. But certainly you can improve. I was at a seminar once with a famous behavioral psychologist by the name of Arnold Lazarus out of Rutgers. And Lazarus told us a story about a young architect that was not getting any employment as an architect. He was just working as a draftsman because he just couldn't. Whenever he interviewed for jobs, he just flopped. And Lazarus explained to us that he was referred to Lazarus by a. This is where it gets kind of fun and edgy. He was referred, the patient was referred to Lazarus by a psychodynamically oriented therapist who was retiring and moving to Florida. And so, and he respected Lazarus, so he refers this young guy to Lazarus. And the guy comes into the office and has this wimpy handshake and no eye contact. And Lazarus says, is that how you meet people when you go on, job interviews? And he says, yeah. He says, okay, well, come back outside my door and then come in again and try it again, try it a little better, okay? Guy was still lousy. So Lazarus spent the session showing this guy how to meet and shake hands, how to open his hand up, how to aim, and then once you hit the hand, you actually move your hand, slide it deeper, okay, and then take your other hand, and then you take your left hand and then go touch the person's wrist, and so when you shake the hands, you give them a firm but not hard handshake, et cetera, but you make your hand very easy to hit and to grasp, and as soon as they touch it, then you slide it very quickly, so there's a nice, deep handshake, et cetera. So they worked for an hour on that handshake, okay? And then over the next 6 weeks, he then did mock interviews with him, and got tougher and tougher on the interviews. The guy brought in his little portfolio. They essentially worked at this presentation, and they worked it and worked it and worked it and worked it. And in no time, this guy got a good job, okay? And he came in, he was all excited about it. And he said he also talked the cop out of a parking ticket. And he says then he also asked out a girl behind a counter at Macy's who turned him down. And Lazarus said, why did you think you could do that? We hadn't gotten to that yet. And the guy said, I just felt like I was on a roll. So point is that you can't change your personality, but you can take pieces of what it is that you need, and you can drill and you can get better. So there would be things that this young person could do if he's in a leadership role. Obviously, if he's got high intelligence and he's sort of slated for leadership, there are and he's getting some comments about his interpersonal his interpersonal style. You're not going to get great, but you can be not terrible, and that can be studied and should be practiced.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it.
Very good. I think that's a wrap for me. Unless we got something pressing, you got anything else?
Nope. That's good. We are going to go over the next episode. We're going to go over the rest of the questions. I've got a lot of questions from everybody over the last couple of weeks, because last week we had the callers and this week we had the show dedicated to the future. So Andrew, Elizabeth, Alex, Kara, Tim, we've got all the emails from you. We're going to put them on as much as we can next show. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. And in the U.S. here, we're going to be celebrating Thanksgiving next week. So Dr. Lyle, have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Very good. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.